Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order. The time is 5:10. Today is Monday, February 27th, 2006. Present, we have Representative Coghill, Dahlstrom, and Kurtula, and myself, Representative Newman. Tonight, we're going to not do any legislation, but hear a presentation from Mr. Harry Kopp. Harry has come to Alaska at a very auspicious time with our present-day discussions on the future economies of the state. Mr. Kopp is a former Foreign Service officer and a consultant on international trade. He is also the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Trade and Policy in both the Carter and Reagan administrations. Currently, Mr. Kopp lectures and writes on international affairs. He is also the author of the book Commercial Diplomacy and the International Interest, which was published in 2004 by the American Academy of Diplomacy and the Business Council for International Understanding. Mr. Kopp, we're very pleased to welcome you to our committee. We're going to ask the members of the committee to hold their questions till the end so we can maintain the flow here on our presentation. You do have the presentation on paper in front of you, so maybe write your questions down as you go along so you don't forget them. Please proceed, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Could you please state your name for the record?
I'm
just going to have to speak into this.
Okay. I'm Harry Kopp. I'm delighted to be here. You say that too. More copies of the book that you mentioned have been sold in Alaska than anywhere else. So I know that interest in this subject is high. I want to start off by talking about what the subject is, because I think it's always a good idea to go back to basics. The two goals of American foreign policy are security and prosperity. They're fundamental purposes of government. They're in the first sentence of the Constitution of the United States. And diplomacy is one of the tools of foreign policy that the government uses to achieve these goals. Most people, when they think about diplomacy, they think of what Henry Kissinger used to do. You go flying around the world talking to really bad people and giving them good reasons to improve their behavior. The purpose of that kind of diplomacy is security. It's providing for the common defense. There's another kind of diplomacy, which we call commercial diplomacy, that gets a little less attention. Commercial diplomacy involves negotiations on trade, investment, finance, patent protection, export promotion, and the like. It's diplomacy that aims at prosperity or promoting the general welfare.
Excuse me, Mr. Kopp, but for the record, we have been joined by Representative Crawford. Please proceed. And Representative Lynn.
Hi.
One question I want to deal with right away is whether the government should be doing this stuff at all. Some of you may remember that about 10 years ago, there was a move in the U.S. Congress to get the government out of this business, to close down the Department of Commerce, to stop funding the Export-Import Bank and other trade promotion agencies. Support for trade was widely attacked as corporate welfare. And along the same lines, there were calls for the United States to pull out of the World Trade Organization, which was denounced as a tool of big and evil corporations, and still is denounced sometimes as a tool of big and evil corporations. I want to give the arguments against those theories and make the case for a very active commercial diplomacy. First of all, trade is good for prosperity, and it's also good for security and peace. Commercial diplomacy has produced a lot of prosperity around the world. The trading system that was put into place after World War II has worked pretty much as its designers planned. Since 1950, as you can see on this chart, trade is up over 20 times. world output has risen 8 times and world population about 2.5 times. So that you can see trade has pulled up output and made people richer. And we know that the wealth that trade creates is not evenly distributed. Peace is not evenly distributed either. In fact, the countries that are most involved with the international trading system are the countries that are best off, that are most prosperous, growing most rapidly, and also generally the most peaceful places. The countries that are least engaged with the international trading system include some of the most dangerous places in the world and some of the poorest. The World Trade Organization has 149 members, and here's a list of some of those who are not members: Afghanistan and Belarus and Bosnia, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, Laos, North Korea, Yemen, Syria. It's sort of the roll call from hell. This is another way of showing that when, as the old saying goes, when goods and services cross borders, armies don't. Tom Friedman, who writes on foreign affairs for the New York Times, expressed the same idea a few years ago when he pointed out that no two countries that have McDonald's restaurants have ever gone to war. So a more peaceful and prosperous world is one reason why the government ought to be hard at work at commercial diplomacy. And here's another reason. It's that U.S. success in business is a cause, and maybe the most important cause, of U.S. global leadership. The United States is the world's largest exporter and the world's largest importer. And also, although it's not on this chart, the world's principal source of investment funds and the world's main destination for investment funds. The United States is very much the engine of the world's economy. The numbers tell us that the United States is, in fact, one of the few really good places in the world to do business. It's the most lucrative place to sell. It's the most reliable place in which to buy, the safest to invest, the best place to raise capital. And more than military power, it's this strength in business that makes the United States a leader. And that I say that because it's our business strength that people want to follow. And in a way, what makes leaders is followers. That's what people want to follow. People in other countries look at American prosperity and they ask, well, how did that happen? How did the Americans get where they are? How do we get there too? What is it in the American experience that we can absorb, that we can apply to our circumstances? They know that U.S. business success owes a lot to the U.S. business climate and to the business infrastructure. And by that I mean to our mobile and our educated workforce, our willingness to take risk, our willingness to innovate, to accept technological change, and our reliance on contracts and laws. This last point's really important, the reliance on contracts and laws. We all tell lawyer jokes. Some of them are pretty funny. But in the end, in fact, we are a much stronger country because we settle disputes in court, and when a judge issues an order, we obey. There are a lot of countries where that doesn't happen. Doesn't happen in Russia. It doesn't happen in China. It doesn't happen in most of the developing world. The legal system here is a very valuable part of the business infrastructure. Sure. Other countries want to copy it. Not necessarily the laws that we have, but the respect for laws. It's part of American leadership by example. That leadership gives us, we have strength also through economic power. That's also part of our leadership. And the United States was 28% of world output in 2005. That's more than the share of world output of the next four countries put together, which is a pretty amazing statistic. but it is not a new situation. In fact, U.S. share of world output has been very high for over 100 years. At the turn of the last century, 1900, the United States accounted for about 38% of world output. It's now 28%. We'll probably continue to dominate the world economy this way for another 20 or 25 years, at which time China is likely to be passing us and taking over first place. This economic power that we have can translate into military strength. U.S. spending on defense is almost equal to defense spending in the rest of the world put together, but it's a very small share, about 4.2% this year of the U.S. economy. 4.2%, as you can see, is a much lower share than in most of the recent past. So a strong economy is essential to our security as well as to our prosperity, and that's another reason why the government needs to be heavily involved in commercial diplomacy. Commercial diplomacy comes in you know, in many flavors, like Baskin-Robbins. I'll talk first about commercial negotiations, and I'm going to divide them into what I call macro and micro. Macro is the big stuff. Negotiations on tariffs and quotas and patents and standards and subsidies, so forth, all kinds of rules that have general application. These are negotiations that require striking a balance among a lot of competing interests and among a lot of different countries. The micro negotiations are the, I won't say the small stuff, but the specific stuff, dealing with specific transactions and specific companies. Will China buy airplanes from Boeing or from Airbus? Will Kazakhstan bring in U.S. or Russian companies to develop oil and gas? This kind of specific negotiation often has winners and losers. It's not so much a question of compromise or striking a balance, but of landing a contract, closing a deal, and coming out on top. Macro diplomacy belongs almost entirely to the federal government, because only the federal government can negotiate trade and investment rules on behalf of the United States. Most of that macro diplomacy is handled by the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, who gets, they get a lot of technical support from other agencies, from the Department of Commerce, from the Department of Agriculture. And, of course, they get oversight from the Congress, particularly the Ways and Means Committee in the House and the Finance Committee in the Senate. Now, states also have a role in macro diplomacy, but the state's role is more to deal with the federal government than it is with the foreigners. So if your constituents come to you and they say, and I'm going to make up these examples, by the way, I'm not going to try to find real problems. If your constituents come to you and say, we're having trouble selling seafood in Korea because of Korean health regulations, you want to make sure that the federal government takes this up with Korea and takes it up in an important way, makes it an important issue. Now, how do you do this? Well, you have to show the federal government, show the executive branch, that the interests of your constituents line up with some big public purpose. And that's really important because, for good reasons and obvious reasons, the federal government wants to be consistent around the world in the way it approaches trade issues. It always wants to have some kind of basic principle at the heart of its argument in any particular case. In this hypothetical example, the basic principle, which is part of international agreements that Korea and the United States have both signed, is that health regulations that affect trade should be based on science. They should protect public health, and they cannot be designed as a way to keep out foreign products. So when you go to the federal government on behalf of your constituents, you want to show that these regulations that are at issue are in fact not based on sound science. You want to work with your constituents to put their complaint together in this way, and maybe you can help them do it, or maybe the state government with its resources can help them do it. And to take the case then to the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. The federal officials will almost always respond very quickly and very favorably if they're given what they need to have in order to go to work. Make it easy for them. And you can also, of course, look for support from the Alaska Congressional Delegation, which is one of the strongest and most able in Washington. Now, let's take another example. Let's say that, and I'm not entirely making this up, let's say that the government of Japan gives big subsidies to its commercial fishing fleet, subsidies that put Alaskan fishermen at a disadvantage. If the Japanese were using their subsidies to sell fish to the U.S. market, we'd have an obvious remedy. We could put taxes on those fish, countervailing duties to offset the subsidies and level the playing field. But let's say that the Japanese subsidies are keeping Alaska fish out of Japanese markets or other Asian markets, and it's not a problem in the U.S. market. In a situation like this, the basic principle and the appropriate remedies are not so easy to see. But there is a U.S. law that provides a way for a private party, like the Alaska fishing industry, to petition the U.S. government, specifically the trade representative, to act against foreign trade practices that are unfair, even if there's no international agreement that clearly covers the situation. So the Alaska, in fact, if the fishing industry for some reason does not wish to file a petition but wants to have a petition filed, the Alaska state government can file a petition on behalf of the industry, so long as the industry substantially supports that. Engagement by the state government would, you know, very strongly add to the political weight behind the petition and increase the pressure on the trade representative to take up that issue and pursue it with Japan at a high level. So there are ways that the state can act to engage the federal government in this kind of negotiation. The state may also get involved with commercial diplomacy if state laws, rather than federal laws or state regulations, are at issue. I'm going to make up another example. Let's say that here in the state legislature, you're considering a bill to increase user fees at the Anchorage Airport with revenue earmarked for airport improvements. Now, you will surely hear from Federal Express, and they'll tell you what you think of all of it, what they think of the legislation. They'll tell you in public testimony and off the record in private communications. But you may not hear much, especially on the record, from foreigners who will be affected by this legislation as well, from foreign shippers and carriers. You might hear from them if you ask them to comment, and you might want to do that. Invite foreign companies to submit statements for the record in writing, or maybe even to appear and give testimony in a hearing orally. Whatever happens in the end, people usually feel better about a decision if they've been involved in the process and they've had a chance to be heard. It may also be that through engaging foreigners in the legislative process, you will build some relationships and a reputation for fairness that will serve you well in the future. Now, that's these are all examples of what I call macro diplomacy, where we're talking about big rules. Micro diplomacy happens when the government steps in between U.S. companies on one side and foreign governments or government-controlled entities on the other side, and that's where U.S. embassies get involved. You know, if a U.S. company is negotiating with a foreign company, two private companies, the U.S. government stays out of the way, has no role. But if a U.S. company is involved somehow with a foreign government, and, you know, that happens all the time, either directly or indirectly because of regulations. When a U.S. company is involved with a foreign government, then the U.S. government has a legitimate role to play. And this is where embassies particularly have a role to play. An embassy, and especially an American ambassador, can be a very powerful ally for American business. For almost every country in the world, the United States is the biggest market. For many countries, the U.S. directly or indirectly provides security. And U.S. importance raises the importance of the American ambassador, raises the importance of that office. As a result, whoever is the ambassador usually has really good access to officials in the host government. A good ambassador will use this access wisely. He builds trust and he builds confidence. He's someone that officials in the host government will pay attention to and take seriously. Now, there are some bad ambassadors out there also. There are guys out there who are lazy or self-indulgent. And they don't meet the people that they ought to meet. They don't speak the local language. They don't understand the local politics. They like to expound their personal views instead of following their instructions from Washington, and that makes them unreliable as representatives of the U.S. president, which is what their job is supposed to be. But these are really exceptions. Most ambassadors and most embassy staffs are competent, very dedicated, and very serious and trustworthy people. Just by indicating their interest in a subject, embassies elevate an issue, particularly a commercial issue. They give it some political weight. A couple of examples that I mention in my book. When a U.S. power company bid on a project in the United Arab Emirates a few years ago, the company asked the embassy to get involved to make sure that the government handled the bid the way it was supposed to. There was some French competition, and the French reputation for passing out bribes and other kinds of kickbacks or sweeteners, that's a very well-known and well-deserved reputation. The company thought if the government here knows the U.S. Embassy is watching them and watching the way they follow their own rules, they'll be more careful, and it will be more difficult for our competitors to bribe their way to success. The embassy did get involved, and they stayed involved for a long period of time, close to 2 years. And in the end, the U.S. company did win the contract. Now, like everybody else, ambassadors and their staffs work well, work at best when they're well prepared. And the best advice that you can give to a company that's working overseas is to keep the embassy informed. Then when there is a crisis, or if there is a crisis, the embassy is ready to act. It's been engaged from an early stage. The other thing is that a company, when it deals with an embassy, needs to tell the full story, not just one side of the story. This is actually a big problem for embassies. They always sometimes only get one side of the story. But if you send an ambassador off to see a foreign minister or a president, and he only knows one side of the story, he's going to be sandbagged. That other side of the story is going to drop on his head while he's talking to the foreign minister or to the president, and it's going to ruin his credibility. So you've got to come clean when you seek assistance from an embassy. There also is some risk in doing this. When U.S. relations with a country are poor, embassy involvement can backfire. A host government may see a chance to play up to nationalist sentiment by saying no to Uncle Sam in a loud voice. Here's an example. When Argentina, a couple of years ago, defaulted on its debts, and, they devalued the currency and they froze all the bank accounts. They imposed price controls. Most of the U.S. companies that had investments in Argentina came to the U.S. embassy and asked for help, but not all of them. Some of them stayed away. One of the big grain traders told me, we thought we had better relations with Argentina than the United States did. So we thought we'd leave the United States out of this. We'd handle our problems ourselves. We thought we would be better off that way. And they may have been right. The embassy and the U.S. government have been trying to solve some of the problems that U.S. companies have in Argentina as a result of the devaluation and the freezing of bank accounts and so forth. They've been trying to solve those problems now for 4 years with very little success. Now, can states get involved in this kind of micro diplomacy? And if a state can get involved, should it get involved? Well, the key here is leverage, and that's why the U.S. government wasn't very successful in Argentina, didn't have any leverage. Much more successful in the United Arab Emirates, because it did have leverage there a couple of years ago, although whether we'll have leverage 2 months from now, that's another issue. Generally, it's the federal government that has leverage to negotiate with foreigners, and only the federal government that really can see the whole range of relationships and can reach then a good judgment on how to handle any particular issue. State officials rarely have leverage. They don't have that broad view. But state officials can steer people, you know, businesses, to the right people in the federal government, to a U.S. embassy, to the Department of State, or the Department of Commerce, or Agriculture, whatever is required. Of course, most businesses can also figure this out for themselves. Where a state government can add value is if it can provide an introduction to businesses that don't know these people, if there's a state official who has developed personal relationships with people in U.S. embassies and key trading partners, with people in Washington agencies, someone who is known and trusted and can be can provide an introduction. Alaska is such an export-oriented state that I think you already have somebody on the payroll who does this sort of work in the governor's office. And that's good. That's work that the legislature ought to keep oversight over. You ought to keep an eye on it and make sure it's done right. State governments have a larger role in two areas, promotion of exports and attracting investment. Alaska is, I think, especially well positioned to make export promotion a state function because the range of goods and services that are available for export is not too large. And because some of these goods and services, tourism obviously, but I think probably also seafood and maybe some wood products, are things that can be Alaska branded. You can say this is seafood is good because it is Alaskan. And if it says Alaska, you know it's quality. And that will work for certain kinds of products. I don't have to tell you about export promotion. You know all about trade missions and trade fairs and all of the techniques that are used to sell things. But I would offer one piece of advice, and that is that you should always charge companies to take part in state-sponsored promotional events, whether it's 50-50 or 60-40, but some substantial amount of money, partly because of fairness. The companies are the big beneficiaries. They ought to support the activity. But more important, if companies pay a substantial fee, they'll make sure that they get their money's worth. They'll set a standard that the government has to meet, and they'll know how to measure success. Programs that don't produce a good return for them, they won't be funded. And programs that do work will be heavily subscribed. It's really the only way you can find out what works. You've got to charge and, you know, set up a little sort of a market, and that will make your programs much more efficient. Promoting inward investment is a very controversial activity. The federal government doesn't do it at all. One reason is that the federal government doesn't do anything that would favor a foreign interest over a domestic interest, or a foreign investor over a domestic investor. Another is that the federal government doesn't want to favor one state or region over another, or at least they don't want to be caught doing it. So the federal policy is strict neutrality. I don't know what Alaska does about foreign investment, but I'm sure you follow a policy also of neutrality between foreign and domestic investors. Probably when you go out to promote investment in Alaska, you're just as eager to get investors from the lower 48 as you are from the rest of the world. And the best thing that you can do to attract investment is to have a business climate that is investor-friendly, whether the investors are foreign or domestic. I mentioned near the beginning of this talk that the U.S. attracts more foreign investment, and I mean direct investment, ownership of businesses, not investment in stocks and bonds, where we attract by far the most. But even in direct investment, the U.S. attracts more than any other country. And we do that even though the federal government is not out seeking investors. That's because of the business climate here. There's a balance of a good return with low risk that is not equaled anywhere in the world. So investment promotion for Alaska is really education. It's making the opportunities here known to investors who otherwise wouldn't be thinking about Alaska. And that's the same whether those investors are in Taipei or in New York. And one way to get investors, to get the attention of foreign investors, is to put Alaska on the itinerary of touring diplomats, whether these are American diplomats who are serving out in the Far East, or diplomats from those countries who are serving in Washington. Find a way to invite them out to Alaska, show them the grandeur of the state and the beauty of the state, and also teach them something about the opportunities that are here and about the legal framework for resource development, which they probably do not know much about. Diplomats will repeat your message to people that count. The people that count are the people who have the money and are in a position to make a commitment of that money. But the diplomats can repeat that message. They're great multipliers of a message in that way. There are some organizations that put tours by diplomats together using a blend of public and private funds, and you might be able to tap into their experience or work with them. John Coghill asked me to talk about what states can do in diplomacy, either on their own or by making the country's national resources go to work for them. I've come up with a few ideas here that I've presented. I'm sure I haven't exhausted the topic, and I expect you'll all have some questions, and I'd be happy to talk about anything I've raised in this presentation or anything else you'd like to say.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Kopp, for your presentation. Representative Berkowitz, would you like to join us up front?
I would love to, but I have to leave very shortly.
Any questions that you want to ask?
Any questions?
No, I'm enjoying the future.
Sir, questions from the committee? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this short time on Earth that I've had, I've watched, you know, the argument between free trade and fair trade, balanced trade. It would seem to me that trade is a really good thing, But when there are large imbalances, when it becomes a problem, and I heard suggestions a few years ago that if we were to, I mean, the U.S. were to unilaterally end their tariff and quota system and replace it with certificates for everything that other countries buy from us that's in a surplus over what they sell to us, that they could we could issue a tradable credit that they could sell to other countries that have a large imbalance, like a China or Saudi Arabia or Japan, you know, so that they could only export what to us what they had credits for, or not credits but certificates for. That would have a tendency to give smaller smaller countries, smaller economies, more cash to buy more of our goods, and would make the crude that we buy from Saudi Arabia or the manufactured goods that we get from China or Japan a little bit more expensive, and have a more of a leveling effect, make our goods more competitive. What would you think about a leveling effect like that in world trade?
I'm not sure I understand the scheme. It sounds like a way to say to raise prices to countries that have trade surpluses with us now.
Right.
And somehow lower prices for certain other countries.
Well, in here, and I don't know which slide it was.
It's a way to sort of make the dollar a lot less fungible than it is now, which I think is a terrible idea. I've got that right.
You say here that we export $1.1 trillion. We import nearly $1.8 trillion.
Yeah.
So we've got a really large imbalance.
Yes.
There. And that has a tendency to foul up our currency. Well, when you have a large imbalance like that. So, you know, a small country or a small economy, just pick any African country that's not an oil exporter. They buy a lot more goods from the U.S. than they sell to us. We could issue them a certificate that they could in turn sell to other economies like Japan or Saudi Arabia, so that those people could export their crude oil or manufactured goods to us.
That is a way, as I say, of making dollars a lot less fungible, so that the dollars that we earn by selling product to certain countries these dollars wouldn't necessarily. Let me see if I'm still not sure I follow this. We would kind of, instead of selling products for money, which is what we do now, we would introduce a new currency called a certificate. And we'll provide those certificates to countries that we have a trade deficit with. And they can sell those certificates to countries that are in surplus.
We have a trade surplus.
Why will those countries that have a surplus with us want to buy them?
Because they wouldn't be able to export their goods and services to us unless they had a certificate to sell
that
to us.
The benefit from the certificate would go to the small country, or the country that was in deficit. Wouldn't go to the U.S.
No.
Well, if we want those countries to have more money, why don't we give them more money? instead of going through this complicated scheme, which is going to screw up our trade.
Because we want them to buy more of our goods. We don't want them to just hand it to them for nothing. This would give them more cash that
boy.
They would be able to buy more goods and services from us.
I'd have to look at the numbers. I will bet if a scheme like that were introduced, we would export less and import less. It would be the net result would be less trade. That I suspect these certificates would turn out to be not quite saleable. But I'd have to look at the numbers, see which countries it is that really have deficits with us. Obviously, our countries that have deficits with us have a lot less in deficit than countries that have surpluses with us have surplus. That's what that's why we have a global trade deficit of half a billion dollars.
Certainly a very complicated issue. Not going to get through a
I'm going to have to, meeting.
It would seem to me that
I would just say I'm real skeptical that something that substitutes certificates for dollars and mucks about in trade this way would have a positive result. But I'd have to study it.
Mr. Kopp, could you inform us or give us a little information on a protocol for a state legislator? Sometimes through our tours around the state here, we run into people with private industry who want to do some investments with foreign industry. Is there any specific or recommended protocol that we should follow besides just going to our ambassadors, or is there any?
I think it's always a good idea if you're going to deal directly with foreign officials to let the Department of State know that you've got these contacts going. You don't want to ask them for permission or have them tell you what it is you got to do or not do, but let them know that what you're up to. That's a good idea, and if they think there's something you need to know that you might not know, they'll tell you. If they say, "Whoa, that oil minister from Nigeria, I got something I need to tell you about the oil minister. He has a history," and you'll find out something that way. It's a good idea to keep them informed, and the best way to do that is to talk to what in the State Department they call the desk officer. There's one officer who's sort of principally in charge of bilateral relations with every country.
I know a real-life experience that Alaska is going through right now is we have a small village in Alaska that's those folks of those village happen to come in contact with some people who want to put in a small nuclear plant to produce electricity there. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for this community and maybe some investment there, but what's the right protocol to try and get those?
This is a foreign group that wants to put up the nuclear plant?
Yeah, a foreign group just happened to could be visiting through there, and they talked to the people from the small village.
I think it would be a good idea for someone, and I don't know who it ought to be, but somebody to pick up the phone, call the Japan desk, the Office of Japanese Affairs in the State Department, and say, we have a delegation from Japan coming to talk to us about a nuclear plant. Don't know where these talks are going, but just thought you might like to make a note of it. Just leave it at that. If there's something they feel that you need to know, that they got to share with you, they'll share it with you. But this is just a way of keeping people informed, keeping them prepared. And then if later on there should be some crisis, and any time you have the word nuclear in a discussion, there's likely to be a public relations crisis, if nothing else. You'll be able to say, But we informed you about this. And on the other side, too, people in Washington may in fact be able to react earlier and more wisely because you've given them a little heads up.
I think they were trying to find a better use for some low-grade uranium there that they could. Michelle, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kopp, for being here. First, just a comment. I had the opportunity to read this book last year, and I skimmed through and found the page on page 51. I want to tell you your comments about identifying underused assets really hit home with me, and I haven't looked at an empty building or an unused piece of equipment the same since I read that. So thank you for stimulating that, and I think that's something that we need to look at statewide in all of our assets. Something else is I was going through the book today. You have a section on security and securing the borders.
Mm-hmm.
Would you comment on what your feelings are and what's going on today with the port situation and potential contracts and the people that we have folks that are concerned, and yet we have a country that's supposedly our ally, and so we have to be very sensitive to feelings there. I'd appreciate hearing your comments on that.
Just with respect to the Dubai ports, as I understand the role of an operator of a terminal, which is what, let me back up, what I understand is going on is that Dubai Ports World has agreed to buy P&O, a British firm.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the P&O, some of the assets of P&O include contracts to operate terminals in 5 or 6 U.S. ports, mostly on the East Coast. So Dubai Ports World would take over the operation of these terminals from P&O. As I understand the role of an operator of a terminal, it is to bring a ship in, unload it, or arrange to have it unloaded, arrange to have it loaded, and send it out again. The terminal operator owns the dock, owns the cranes, the container facility, container transport facilities. Doesn't have anything to do with security. The U.S. government, the Coast Guard, and the Customs and Border Protection folks, in fact, in most cases, will have checked that container before it left a foreign port. They're notified by the master of the vessel before the ship enters U.S. waters. They oversee the unloading of the vessel after it docks in the United States. They check the seals. Who owns the terminal is irrelevant. I think this security question, from what I know, and I'm no expert in this, but from what I know, I think the security question is largely a phony one. And I understand that there's concern because ports are surely sensitive areas, and Dubai, well, I look at a map, it's right there in the Middle East, and two of the September 11th hijackers came from Dubai, came from the United Arab Emirates. I just can't make all these connections come together in a way that makes me say the government ought to step in now and undo a contract that it had already approved, or that the Congress ought to step in and undo a contract that the executive has approved. I think to do that now would be not only a bad signal, I think it would be an injustice to P&O, which has every right to sell its asset, and to the buyer, which had every right to buy it. Now, if over the next 45 days, while Congress looks at this, they turn up something that shows that I'm completely wrong, and in fact, there is a real security risk in transferring control of these terminals from P&O to Dubai Ports World, then, you know, then I'm real wrong, because if there's a security risk, then of course they ought to block the deal.
I appreciate your insight. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargill.
I think one of the things that really grabbed my attention on reading through your book, and it was kind of the convincing thing to ask you to come speak to us, is to raise our awareness of the diplomatic corps and its work, which you've done very well, and then how we can interact with them. And the principles that you outlined in the first part of your book really helped me. And on for those members that have the book here on page 4, it says that the business climate in the United States is excellent, as you said. But you started off with an educated and extremely productive workforce. And this is something that legislatures just agonize over. Every year we're agonizing over, are we getting the best dollar to educate? Are we competitive enough with the world? So that one, what really got me. And then innovation is welcome. I think those are the kind of things, not only in education, but in our rules of play, that we try to figure out how do we get companies to be as innovative as they possibly can, attracting capital in Alaska. Also, the rules are transparent. I think the rule of law definitely is both stable and enforced. But and then borders are open.
Yeah.
Borders are open for trade. We have tried, I think, in Alaska to watch that very carefully. And so all of these things really hit home to me, saying, as a kid born and raised here in Alaska, I want to make sure that we're reaching those movers and shakers in the world that are looking for places to do business that have these assets available. And so I'm looking for ways to hone them down and to talk about our place in the world to help us get that asset built, honed to a better, more productive style. So those are the things I really looked at when I was looking at this. And so when I invited you, I wanted you to help. When I made the pitch for this committee to have you come and talk to us, part of it was to say, okay, what is the universe out there that says the diplomatic corps is doing all these things, tying together the rules, looking for that educated workforce that we're going to no doubt inevitably compete with? So we have to be ready for it. And then how do we as legislators engage without breaking protocol? How do we get aware? I mean, we're busy just like everybody else in the world is, but we've got to be at least one connection away from how do we get to that diplomatic corps. We have, in this governor's office, we have one person that is hired. We've had offices in various different places. We've closed them down because of economics, political issues. So I'm going to be asking this committee, as we review some of the stuff that you brought up, the value of those assets, what we can do to make them better, and then how do we structurally help ourselves look to our governor or whoever, and to those diplomats that choose to have a place in Alaska, like the Canadians actually put a consulate in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
Good for us to talk to them. And so the personal relationship issue is going to be a very important one. So I wanted people here to hear that. And but how did you whittle this down to these handful of things? Are they self-evident? Are they things that have been told in the marketplace? Obviously, I think a educated, extremely productive workforce, but innovation is welcome certainly has some parameters about it. Can you give me an idea of some of the things that have worked well or maybe that haven't worked well as far as that being an asset?
Excuse me, Mr. Kopp. I just need to recognize Representative Rammers has joined us at the table.
Hi, sir. Nice to see you.
Please proceed.
And I didn't know how long you wanted to go. I know it's 6 o'clock, so I asked a question that could be an open-ended answer. So.
Well, the list is derived as much as anything from what investors in the United States say they find attractive about this market, why they want to be here. what we have that attracts people. You know, people don't invest here because we have a cheap labor force. It's because output per worker is very, very high and growing very rapidly. That's our educated workforce that has not only brains, but also has this technological infrastructure to work with. You need both, of course, to be productive. Not only do you need to be smart, you need to have the tools. And our workers are smart, and they do have the tools. And as we've talked about the importance of transparency and laws and good regulation. So that list is derived from really what foreign investors say brought them into the United States.
And Mr. Chairman, and I didn't really expect him to answer all of them because that could go on and on and on, but those are the principles that really rang my bell that says we're responsible for education in Alaska. And if we're going to be a part of that, you know, the transparency of the rules, those are the things that are directly connected with what the world is looking for. And I just want to know, how do we connect taking this whatever asset? If we got to hone our assets, there's that. But then we've got to connect through the federal government and through our diplomatic corps.
Well, you know, diplomats are one tool that you can use. I think you need very much to work with the businesses directly, the people who buy and sell not only goods and services, but also are buying and selling assets, you know, the investors. Those are the people who are, in the end, going to make the commitments of money and their own money and their own time. Diplomats are go-betweens. They're very useful go-betweens. They make connections, but you also need to work directly with the people who make commitments, who are really on the line.
But Mr. Kopp, I'm very pleased that you recognize the fact of good old American get her done in ingenuity. You know, we hear a lot about how some of the testing scores of America's children, you know, maybe are dropping compared to other nations, but the fact of good old get her done ingenuity of Americans is still right up there and something that we're all very proud of. Representative Lynn?
I don't know quite how to frame the question, but I'll give a go at it. How do we safeguard national United States defense interests if we have foreign companies, which may not be owned, you know, by the foreign state, making critical parts that have a military application or potential military application, electronics and so on, if they either have a political problem within that country or that country gets at odds with us at some point in the future. In other words, if we're getting critical military parts made, components made over there, and we go to war with that country, or they just have a civil war in their own country, how do we guard against that type of thing, where we just put our eggs in somebody else's basket and they get squashed?
We shouldn't put ourselves in that position where we have, you know, critical components that are or parts of a supply chain that are at severe risk from some political event overseas. We should do whatever we can. We can't always avoid that situation, but where we can, we should avoid it.
I agree with that, but what is the screening process?
There are a couple of things in place. Well, you've all read about the Dubai ports episode.
Oh, yes.
The reason that was examined at all by this Council on Foreign Investment in the United States, this Treasury Committee that you may have read about, is because of the Exxon Florio Amendment that was passed, when was it, the late 1980s, I think, which is exactly goes to that kind of an issue and deals with investments that with foreign purchases of U.S. assets that may pose a security question. There's also a provision of trade law, I think called Section 232, though I couldn't tell you of which act, that allows the United States to, the United States federal government to inhibit or block the import of products that would compete with U.S. products if those U.S. products are critical military components. And this has been used, for example, in the case of ball bearings, the military the specification ball bearings, to prevent U.S. production of these products from disappearing under foreign competition, because the ball bearings were vital to some aircraft or other military products. This provision of trade law was used to keep out the imports and to protect the American industry. So the Defense Department looks at its supply chain and presumably does a good job of it to see that that supply chain is secure. Certainly it ought to be. And there are, you know, a number of provisions of law to allow the executive to take the action that's needed to protect our supply chains. How good a job they're doing, I don't know.
Thank you very much for that response. It's an issue. You know, obviously we don't want some foreign country we may be at war with in the future producing our bullets for us.
That's right. Now, unfortunately, there's always some critical element that we just don't have.
You know, whether it was, you just need one element to lose a war.
And that's when we try to stockpile stuff that we don't produce but might need, like oil.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Kopp? Thank you, committee members. At this time, I'd also like to ask have you received a copy of this book?
I'd like to get another copy of it.
The committee will certainly purchase what we need to for the members of this committee. And if not, we'll try and make sure we get access to the books, and maybe Mr. Kopp can tell you how to do that after the meeting. At this time, we'll close this committee, and have a good evening. And again, thank you, Mr. Kopp, for your presentation.
Thank you.